The Athletic. Japan MotoGP 2022. For you, was it the standout first victory of the 2022 season that Jack Miller took? Or was it the troublesome eighth position that championship leader Fabio Quartararo got throughout the weekends of a limited dry running? Maybe the mess that championship chaser Pecco Bagnaia got himself into by throwing it into the gravel on the last lap. It was an embarrassing standout as Ducati go from shall we have team orders to our main man binned it as he lunged from ninth to what could have been eighth. Paddock underdogs Aprilia made a bit of a mistake on the grid and left an outlap setting on Aleix Espargaró's bike, meaning he had to leap onto the spare at the end of the warm-up lap, leaving him to start from pit lane and ultimately score nothing when the barn door was left wide open. Or was it seeing Marc Marquez back on a pole position? A wet pole at that. But after nearly 1,100 days since the last, it's been great to see. We've got all sorts of things to discuss. Simon Patterson, Valentin Hrunci, join me, Toby Moody, as we make sense of it all. But the bottom line is that Quartararo was the one with the coolest head and turned a 10-point lead to an 18-point lead in the title chase with 100 points still on the table. That's how I look at it. How do you look at it, Val?
Yeah, exactly the same. Exactly the same. I don't think he had much business going away from this weekend with a championship lead increased by almost double. And it didn't look pretty even during the race, because I think we all felt that at some point Bastianini was going to switch on and then Bagnaia was going to switch on and they were going to gobble him up the way Miller gobbled up opposition at turn 11 over and over and over again. And it didn't quite happen. Fabio, I think, had a really weird race by standards, because even when he was briefly in clean air, he didn't look very fast at all. And considering that he says he didn't have major front tire pressure issues, you just wonder if it's just a general lack of pace. Although it seemed pretty decent in Friday practice. So in that sense, getting away with an extra 8 points over Pecco is huge. It's really big, especially given how the previous five races have gone.
I think whenever we spoke to Quartararo after the race, he was quite relieved. And he kind of didn't really go into too much in the way of like detail about what had gone so wrong. But I think the most interesting comments at the end of the day came from Cal Crutchlow. Because he was bemoaning the fact that he also had really, really good pace, but just couldn't get past people. And I think there was an element of that with Quartararo as well. I think he lost most of his time trying to find a way past Maverick Vinales in front of him and just couldn't do it, because this is probably the one circuit where, more than anything, that horsepower disadvantage that the current Yamaha is at really, really, really penalizes them, because they come out of so many slow corners here and it's not the top speed, it's the acceleration where they're struggling. So he was just unable to overtake anyone, and as a result just couldn't go forward. And I think they kind of realized that was going to be an issue, and as a result of that they leave very, very happy from Yamaha's home race.
The point that gives me pause is it didn't feel like he was particularly close to anybody during the race, if that makes any sense. Like when you watch somebody like Vinales in a race try to find a way past, or when you, I don't know, in the Moto2 race, watch the Gusto Fernandez try to work his way past Alonso Lopez, hounding him at every corner, you know, basically desperately trying to find some silly way around the outside that's never going to work. Fabio, I'm guessing it's a decision that he can't really afford to do that, because there's no point. Because most of his race, I think you're right, it was two stages. The first stage was just dropping back and getting passed by Luca Marini. And then the second stage was getting... did he get passed by Marini, or was he already behind? Well, it doesn't matter. But the second part was indeed following Vinales, but never really getting particularly close to anything. But as he put it after the race, not only did I not overtake, I didn't even get to try. So in that regard, given how hopeless and not fun that race was for him, it's a real gift to come out of it with a doubled points lead, basically. Real gift.
I wonder if maybe he was aware of where... Well, we know he was aware of where Bagnaia and Espargaró were behind him. And he knew that if he did get close enough to someone to risk an overtake, it would also risk putting that front tire pressure up through the roof. And that's whenever it gets really risky, whenever you start to lose front feeling. So I wonder if he just... He'll never say it, but I wonder if that was a race where he was just managing championship expectations and would have been happy to have finished it, having conceded maybe 1 or 2 points to Bagnaia, which looked like the kind of the worst case scenario for him with one lap to go. That looked like the worst case scenario.
Yeah.
Coming off a non-score, of course, he just needed something. He will have known that Aleix Espargaró was at the back. He will have known that Bagnaia was behind him, and ultimately he actually heard Bagnaia crashing behind him on the hairpin double left behind the pits on that last lap. Quite what Bagnaia was doing, taking all the risks just for 1 point, is beyond me. What a difference a week is in MotoGP as we're on the other side of the planet between the discussions that the world and the press office are having about Ducati.
I have a theory, and it's a theory I'm only maybe 50% on board with, but it's a theory nonetheless. When your manufacturer doesn't give you the points that are on the table, you have to go out and try to get them yourself. So there were 5 points available easy at Aragon with some race manipulation. Easy for Bagnaia, not easy for Ducati in terms of PR, but easy for Bagnaia. Those 5 points did not go into his wallet. And so perhaps he's felt the pressure to outrace Quartararo to just knowing that he'll have to do it by himself. He'll have to get this done over himself. And maybe there was a feeling that beating Quartararo here in this kind of race where he's weak would be a psychological blow of sorts. Maybe I'm just overthinking it. He just wanted to pass his rival up ahead. That's probably it. Any case, didn't work. It was not good. It was a really, really bad mistake from a rider who stamped them out for a bit. But lucky him that the run was so good that it's a mistake he could afford. But it's the only one he can. That's it. We're done. Rest of it has to be perfect, basically, from here on out.
See, I don't think that... I don't think he was thinking too much, per se, because what we've historically seen from Pecco is that he has moments where he stops thinking on track and does something really dumb and stupid. And I think it's fair to say that we've tried this year in the podcast to give him the benefit of the doubt and say that, you know, that sort of tendency to make dumb mistakes that essentially in the end cost him the title last year by crashing out of a race win at Misano, we kind of presumed that he'd put that behind him this year. And then he went and did something really rash and stupid that I think was just a mistake without thinking about a mistake. He did not need to pass Fabio Quartararo right away, because everything we've just said about why Quartararo had such a tough day, that slow acceleration out of slow speed corners, he would have absolutely zapped him, you know, a couple of corners later if he'd waited and thought about it. But he got behind him and just went, pass. And yeah, cleared away from him. I think maybe the only thing, to give him a little bit of credit, maybe the only little bit thing that he was thinking about was he was trying to put a bike between him and Enea Bastianini. And that's then arguably whenever there is a conversation about team orders comes into things. He was trying to be defensive by going on the offensive and putting a blocker in between the person he was most afraid of being able to pass him in the last lap.
Yeah, I didn't think of that, but that's a really good point, because when you think last lap threat, Enea is it, and Enea showed in the race that he's not too interested in playing nice and taking it easy, that he'll take the points that are available from Pecco or anybody else. It's a question to Ducati, again, not... But what Pecco did say, that he tried to dispatch with Fabio as soon as possible to go after Maverick, but that was not happening. The gap was a little bit too big. I can't really see how that was particularly possible, but I can understand how in the heat of the last lap you would think it maybe is. As far as benefit of the doubt goes, it did like finish in the top two in the five races before that. I'm fairly forgiving when you have a run like that. I think in most seasons, you can afford to do something like this every six races if the rest of the six races are basically pitch perfect. But there's a hole that he dug himself into at the start of the season, and he's basically dug himself out. But it means the room for error that would normally be there isn't really there. It was there for Fabio. It's not really there for Pecco. I think he's not in huge trouble yet. 18 points. If he wins the last four races, he's champion, whatever happens. I mean, it's in his hands, which is, I think, meaningful. But he's not going to win Phillip Island, for instance.
But when you get on a plane and you go to four Asian flyway races and you bin it on the first one, and you're in hotel rooms and you're on aircraft and you're not going home and you're surrounded by the warm, fuzzy feeling of base, home, all you do on these flyway races, and Simon knows, all you do is MotoGP for 4 weeks. There's nothing else in your life. And it's even more so with the racers. So it's just going to be that worm in the back of his mind that hopefully doesn't eat away at the back of Bagnaia's mind too much. The cold facts are, unfortunately for Bagnaia, 16 races in, crashed in five. You ain't going to win a world championship doing that.
Yeah. And there will be a claim that not all of those crashes have been his fault, but equally there have been crashes where he's taken other people out with him, which kind of balance, not another title contender, don't get me wrong, but you know, he's not been the innocent victim of five people's mistakes this year, has he?
No. Recently, I think he deserves credit for the recent run still, and I think he's more reliable than he used to be. But still, you know, when this kind of thing shows up, it's natural to ask questions, to look at it and to have doubts. And to, I think it'll be natural for him too to have a bit of doubt over whether he's letting his best chance go to waste with mistakes like that. It didn't need to be an 8-point swing, did it? I mean, just didn't need to be that. And here we are.
It's such a different character that we've seen today from Bagnaia, compared to winning in Assen, Silverstone, Red Bull Ring, Misano, second last week in Aragon, and then he goes and does that. It's just, it is the proverbial Jekyll and Hyde, isn't it?
And his character all weekend has been quite different, with things going against him a little bit. He's been quite vocal and outspoken in his unhappiness with Ducati, which is not something we've heard. It's not even something we heard at the start of the year, actually, whenever the new bike wasn't really up to scratch yet. He was always sort of quite a moderating tone then about, you know, we know that this is a new project, we know that things will be better, blah, blah, blah. He's this weekend saying straight up, this is not acceptable, the bike is not working in the wet, it's not good enough, you know. That is not something we've heard from him this year before.
A team order's in the back of his mind, Simon? Is there something going on?
It's becoming more and more apparent that there are not the factory orders that we thought there were at Ducati, or if there were, that they're not really being given much heed by a certain satellite team. There was a clip of Davide Tardozzi in the garage, the early stages of the race, where just after Bastianini had put a quite aggressive overtake on Bagnaia, Tardozzi had cut a shot of Tardozzi in the garage. He looked furious, and he then sort of stormed out of the garage. It turns out he stormed straight to the Gresini pit wall box to give them a bit of what he felt about that overtake. We saw an aggressive overtake from Bagnaia's 2023 teammate. We saw Bagnaia essentially forced to make a similarly aggressive overtake back on Bastianini at the end of the race. And then we saw him crashing out with Bastianini breathing down his neck. which is not something the Ducati team order should be doing really at this point, is there?
It's strange how this situation came to be. And again, it is worth saying that at no point in any public address of Pecco's, including this weekend and including any other weekend, has there been any clamoring for team orders. And in fact, on Thursday, he said, I do not need them to win this title, which looked more realistic then than it does now. But, you know, whatever. I genuinely believe that he believes that. And I honestly have no reason to doubt his earnestness in not wanting help. And he's not said anything negative about how Enea Bastianini has raced him. But the fact is that Bastianini is putting him under extra pressure. And the fact is that Ducati will not tell him to stop. So what I found really interesting is when, if you watch that race, you notice a point before sort of Bagnaia finds his rhythm, you notice the point where Bastianini passes him with that aggressive turn 10 pass. And then the next guy after him is Marco Bezzecchi. And you get the feeling that Bezzecchi also has the pace to do it, to get it done on Bagnaia. The Bagnaia is really struggling. And speaking to media post-race, Bezzecchi did in fact confirm that he felt he had the pace to put a move on Bagnaia, but thought about it and decided, I'll just stay behind him. Don't really need this. And I think that's what Ducati wants from everybody in its stable, but it doesn't want the PR hit of asking. It wants every single rider to just decide that on their own. And the problem there is that, of course, Marco Bezzecchi, like Bagnaia, is a Valentino Rossi protege, so they're good friends. They train together, they work together, they're on the same wavelength. And Bastianini, in that regard, is an outsider who also wants to assert himself over Bagnaia as his future teammate. So it's, you can have your cake and eat it too with Bezzecchi, but not with everybody. And look, I don't know if you've noticed it, Simon, but I've caught some social media grief over mentioning the team orders thing over and over again, as sort of the intimation that it's the journalists that are pushing this topic, much like with rider unions before. I don't know if that's true or not. I don't think Ducati likes talking about it very much, but you'd have to be blind not to see how Bastianini is complicating this title campaign for Bagnaia. It is an objective fact. It is the truth. Like, if Ducati doesn't want to acknowledge that truth, we will.
And let's put it this way. I spoke to every team boss I spoke to this weekend raised the subject with me, not the other way around. So it's not fair to say that this is something that's being led by the journalists just because we may or may not be the ones that are reporting on what people are telling us. I spoke to a few people this afternoon after the race and we discussed a few topics and they kind of helped me form a theory about why we're seeing what we're seeing from Bastianini right now, actually. And it makes complete sense to me. Essentially, he can still win the championship. That is still mathematically possible, although it's unlikely. But it is quite mathematically possible that he can finish top three in the championship. That's not that big an ask. Now, we know that Ducati pay small salaries, big bonuses. There is a seven-figure lump sum, I'm sure, if he finishes top three in the championship. Why would he feel any need to concede anything to Pecco Bagnaia when he's essentially fighting him for that spot if Ducati haven't come along and offered him a seven-figure payout to back off?
No, that's very easily resolved, isn't it? If that is the case, it is.
That's very easily resolved with a big check. Yeah. But he's managed by Carlo Pernat, who is the most cunning old hand when it comes to rider management in the MotoGP paddock. And I can absolutely imagine Pernat sitting down in front of Paolo Ciabatti and Davide Tardozzi and Gigi Deligna saying, we will absolutely let Pecco ride away from us every weekend once you sign the check.
Exactly. What's in it for me?
Money in the account, then we'll talk. But right now, they're not just... This is not a case of Jack Miller versus Pecco Bagnaia, where... Miller has no threat to him. They're not fighting each other for anything. Bagnaia and Bastianini still have at least one eye on the same prize, and that's a problem of Ducati's own making.
running away, literally, with the victory at Motegi. Jack Miller aboard the factory Ducati. He, well, clicked it into top gear, and that was the last that anybody ever saw of his number 43 between then and the end of the 24 laps. He eventually won the race by 3.5 seconds. I'm surprised it wasn't about 7, which is gargantuan in this day and age of MotoGP. Was the lack of running something to do with it, do you reckon, Val? Or was it just the right tyre? Or do you think Espargaro would have given him a bit of a run, as Espargaro, we will hear about in a minute, says?
Espargaro thinks he would have. I'm really not convinced. In terms of lack of running, it's hard to say, because I guess Jack does sort of hit the ground running sometimes, but I don't, you know, it's just, I think it's just the track and the package that he had clicked with him. And you say you expected it to be about 7 seconds. I think it would have been about 6 if he didn't pop a massive wheelie over the line and just, you know, screw about for the final lap. Absurdly dominant win. It was by far Jack Miller's best MotoGP race by a very comfortable margin. And the kind of race that not only was I not particularly confident that he can do in MotoGP, but as Jack repeatedly admitted in various media appearances after the race, he was not confident he could have done. But it was just perfect. It was just perfect. It was such an, I don't want to say on Miller, because that's a really harsh thing to say, but in terms of how it turned around, you know, he wasn't so good in the pure wet, where you normally would expect Jack to be one of the top ones. I guess he didn't have his exact ideal sort of drying track conditions. But in the dry, he was just on his own, really, completely unmatched. Already on Friday, I guess you could see that he topped the Seoul session. He would have topped it by more if he didn't get caught up behind Suzuki tester Takuya Tsuda on his fastest lap. And then on Sunday, just like, he could have won by 7 if he needed to win by 7. He was much faster than everybody else. He was overtaking with no trouble whatsoever to walk through his overtakes. Zarco out of turn 2, Vinales aggressively turn 5, 2 bikes into turn 11, then another bike into turn 11, then another bike into turn 11. So that's 2 laps and 3 corners, or 2 laps and, sorry, 11 corners, and the lead from 7th on the grid without a particularly great getaway off the line, and then gone. It was absolutely fantastic. It was a win we more associate with his teammate Bagnaia, but I'm not even sure I've seen Bagnaia do something like this. It's really good. And you expect, you know, Jack normally to run out of pace towards the end a little bit, and that never happened even a little bit. He was perfect. He was phenomenal.
He did admit towards the end that if he'd had to fight with someone, he might have been in a world of trouble because there wasn't much left in the tires. But he'd done such a good job by that point that there was no need to ever even think about it. Yeah, it's not the sort of victory I ever thought we'd see from Miller, because he's a scrapper. He's not a someone that leads from start to finish, but it was beautifully done. No credit to him for that.
Yes, it was Lorenzo-esque, really, wasn't it? And yeah, how fitting is it that the irony of Jack Miller now taking away the race lap record from Jorge Lorenzo, that unbelievably has stood for 8 years. Oh, goodness me. 2014, long time ago. Aleix Espargaró aboard the factory Aprilia. What a whole world of pain and everything that he's gone through today. We'll go into the details of it right now, but I have to say this: the mechanic that made the mistake with the settings on the bike, all he could do was say, "Don't worry, mate, I'll give you a hug. We've all just got to move on to Thailand." I mean, it's the only thing you can do, isn't it?
It would be the only thing that a rider would be able to do in any circumstance, but let's not forget that this is the rider that threw away 9 points earlier this year because he didn't read his pit board. There has to be a little bit of Aleix Espargaró's mind that knows tonight that he can't be too angry about this, because everyone makes mistakes, and God knows he's made his this year as well. So it sounds, I spoke to team boss Massimo Rivola afterwards, as well as speaking to Aleix, and it sounds like they have a special map that they only use for siding laps, which limits the bike to 100 kilometers an hour. It's designed, Rivola told me, to save every gram of fuel possible, because marginal gains, saving every little bit everywhere you can, because everyone's always on the limit. That map then has to be basically switched off using a laptop connected to the bike and the grid, and someone didn't do that.
Yeah.
It's a mistake. Mistakes happen. It was human error. So both Espargaro and Rivolo, when I asked, said it wasn't necessarily anything to do with the current calendar, but I'm not entirely sure about that, because simply put, everyone in Aragon stays an hour away from the circuit and has to do that drive both ways each day. Then we fly to here, where everyone stays an hour away from the circuit and has to do that drive each day. It's long days here. It's tiring. Everyone's jet lagged, and you know, that increases the chance of mistakes. So maybe it didn't play a role. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it did. We'll never really know. But either way, mistake happened. And, you know, speaking to Rivola, what has made Rivola such a smart operator at Aprilia is that he was immediately very, you know, matter of fact, it happened. We now have to determine if our procedures for the start of the race are too complicated. We need to go and find someone who thinks like an airline pilot to write a triple redundancy checklist so that this never happens again. But we also have to go away and look at how we manage the entire start procedure of the bike to make sure it's not too complicated, to remove the number of items on that triple checklist as well. I don't really know what else the team could do in the circumstance other than, you know, put in a triple lock to make sure it never happens again, because it happened. Aleix believed that he would have been able to win the race, which is traditional rider psyche. Rivola believed that he would be able to finish on the podium in the race, which is a lot more realistic. But either way, they threw away double-digit points today.
So it's a, you know, it's a young team. It's a team that's new to this level of competition in MotoGP, and sort of, you know, it's a team that's obviously partly new, I guess, after the Gresini split. So it's gonna happen.
Yeah.
The timing sucks. It really sucks, and it really hurts. And as Aleix put it, if Fabio and Pecco finished 1 and 2, it would be better for the championship. It would be worse for the championship, but it would feel better. But because they both had clangers, Aleix is like, you know, it's not so often that I'm just much quicker than both. And that was the case today. And I think it was. Yeah, I think that's probably accurate.
Yeah.
So, you know, if he finishes third or fourth, he's right there. He's right in the thick of the title fight suddenly. And instead, he's 25 points off. It's not over. But when you're Aprilia in this sort of stage of the championship, I think you need to maximize every points opportunity. And this is one they've really not maximized, if you see what I mean. So
I think it was Estoril and Ben Spies works Yamaha days, but when they changed the tires on the grid, they used to put one of those medical clips on the brake pipe that would stop the flow of brake fluid down to the caliper. And they then changed everything around. And of course, he started the warm-up lap, and this thing was still attached. So he had to come back into the pits, and he lost his slot and pit lane start and everything. So what Yamaha do now, they still do it, but then from going on from there, they put one of those red aviation remove before flight tags on. And also, David Coulthard, he started a Monaco Grand Prix with things stuck in the side pods of the McLaren that were there to keep heating the engine. But of course, once he got going, there was no through flow of air. Was it DC? Was it Jensen? I can't remember. And of course, it blew the engine up in like half a lap because it had no cooling whatsoever. It's happened before. It'll happen again, but Val, your particular English word is fantastic. A clanger, and the wrong time to do it.
I have to give him credit for one thing. It says a lot about Aleix Espargaro's complete and utter commitment that he got into pit lane on his number one bike and just crashed it because it was quicker than getting off it. Yeah. Like, there's a certain amount of commitment there, because that could have backfired. Like, the airbag could have fired in his suit. That could have actually, you know, didn't even think about it. Well played. Yeah. Fair play to that one.
I did notice that the brake master cylinder, it didn't even have the little sweatband on it, the little Brembo sweatband on it. So
you could see the fluid swishing around.
And of course, to be fair, that bike was only going to get used if it was a wet part of the race. You were there, Simon. I don't think there was even 200% chance of rain.
I think what that bike was set up for was a red flag, because they had the soft tire in it.
Yeah,
and then that was the problem. That was the reason he couldn't make more progress, because he could basically only use the medium rear, and the soft just started to fall apart on him. A few people who experimented with the soft Michelin over the weekend were complaining that it was actually starting to fall apart in the center of the tire in the straights because of all the upright acceleration out of those slow corners. And there was a few others. Mark Marquez used the soft rear, I think.
In the race, yes, he did.
Vinales said that he probably should have used the soft rear, but Alesia's yes. a lot bigger and a lot heavier, and it just wasn't working for him, and that was the problem. But yeah, I think what we saw there was a bike that was probably not set up for rain, set up for a quick restart.
For Mark, it really worked. It really, really worked.
It really worked for him.
Like, it worked to the point where he could overtake for fourth place with two laps to go, a rider who, I don't remember what Miguel was on, but it was not the soft rear. So it really worked.
Medium. I think the KTM guys said they couldn't use the hard rear.
Yeah.
But Brad Binder did say that it was his crew chief who said, take this tire. You've got to believe in it. Remember, they only had 20 minutes of dry warm-up on Sunday morning. Everything else was wet. And he came out with the third KTM podium from the entire year. And this, during the first time on a big bike at Motegi.
Yeah. Yeah. Same goes for Jorge Martin on the podium too. So also impressive. But yeah, Brad's... Because honestly, for much of the weekend, I felt this was one of those relatively rare 2022 weekends where Miguel actually had the upper hand. And yet, in the end, it's a fairly familiar result. Miguel Miguel rode a decent race.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I'm sorry. F1, MotoGP, double duty. They're currently on F1 break, so you'd think I wouldn't do stuff like this, but yeah. Anyway, yeah, Miguel rode a decent race. Apparently, there was some unseen contact between Miguel and Brad when, if you watched on TV, you would have seen just Miguel suddenly lose a position. And what happened there was apparently he ran a bit wide in turn one and then got sort of forced out wide by Brad, who didn't.
Yeah. I asked him about it afterwards. There was a bit of contact between them. Miguel was completely cool with it. He said, you know, this is racing. These things happen. It wasn't a major thing. It just dropped him back a little bit, cost him a few tenths.
Yeah. And Brad was fairly apologetic because he didn't know that Miguel was there. And anyway, we didn't see it. It doesn't sound like anything too dramatic happened. The dramatic part that happened is that Binder was again ahead and then managed to reel in and pass Martin. And look, we're going to do a top 10 thing at the end of this season. I think I have my top five, but I don't know the order. And every weekend like this is just a nightmare. Like, where am I going to... Are there really, like, say, four riders in MotoGP better this year than Brad Binder? I don't know. I am really not sure. So, it's another really, really good race by him. And look, Jack this weekend showed a reason to believe that he'll hold his own against Brad next year, but Brad showed a reason to believe that it's going to be the toughest challenge of his MotoGP career, of Jack's.
I'm fairly sure, actually, that what we might see next year is something along the lines of what we see this year with or in past years as well, with Oliveira versus Binder, where Jack wins more races, but Binder finishes the championship higher. I think that might be the take from it. Yeah. Just one thing to throw out there while we're talking about Miller, Binder, and Jorge Martin on the podium, that's worth mentioning. We've been coming to Japan for Grand Prix races since 1963, and today is the first day in history that there was no Japanese bike on the podium at a Japanese Grand Prix. If that's not a sign that times are a-changing, I don't really know what it is. That is a huge thing for me. You know, for three, four companies that have dominated this championship, because there are Kawasaki 500 Grand Prix podiums at Suzuka as well. But yeah, what a stat.
And one Japanese bike in the top seven, right? If I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, sounds about right.
Yes, the Honda of Marc Marquez was fourth.
The Honda of Marc Marquez.
And yet,
And the next one was the Yamaha of Quartararo.
And yet, you have to think that Yamaha and Honda management are too upset about today, because one of them moved closer to another world title and the other got their superstar back.
And they really did.
Which is probably a weird way to look at it, but it wasn't a bad day for the Japanese manufacturers, despite that stat, which is kind of weird.
What is the best thing about this Motegi weekend we've just seen is there's been an HRC wildcard, and man alive, did it look cool. So it's all good. It's all fine. The world will continue to spin for another 12 months.
You say that, Toby, but they missed the ultimate trick. Every HRC-branded bike should have gold wheels.
Very true.
It didn't have gold wheels. The wheels should always be gold.
But it did look good, though, didn't it?
It looked good. It looked really good. And it was quite fast as well, which is even more impressive.
Yeah.
Tetsuka Nagashima was quick.
For those not in the know, Tetsuta Nagashima, Moto2 veteran, won, I think, one Moto2 race, maybe a couple. I'm not entirely sure.
Yeah. First race of 2020. Yeah. And then we went in a 4-month break and he never quite found his form again.
But yeah, you know, he's earned this one, and he's been doing some work for Honda, and also I think endurance racing for them. The big Honda storyline.
One Suzuki at R for them.
With Lecuona and I don't remember. Sorry.
Takahashi.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Yeah. The big Honda... Sorry,
motorcycle endurance racing is my thing. Yeah.
Stop digging, Val.
The big Honda thing from this weekend is that we've seen our Marc Marquez again. And we've seen him, you know, just sort of the right way where you don't expect him to dominate next year. You don't really fear it. But you expect him to be really properly in the mix now. Because, you know, the package is still not great. Again, this is Honda's best finish since May 1st, which was before the fourth surgery. But he was really good all throughout the weekend. Really, really good. He had longevity in the race. And obviously he had the... So that... It's good to see that Marquez thing of just being on another planet when the grip is a bit weird. It's good to see that hasn't gone. I'm honestly not sure when we're going to see another rider who's this good at every level of grip. And it's such a... That maybe grew a little bit boring during his domination years, but now on weekends like this, when you see it and you're like, you know, the bike isn't so good anymore and Mark's still recovering to full fitness, but that grip feel, that's still there. It's beautiful. It's an absolutely beautiful pole position. Loved it to bits.
Spoke to him afterwards, after the race, and asked him about, you know, so the ultimate Marc Marquez for me is 2019, the year that he was in the podium in every race. His worst finish was second. He was in the podium in every race but one, and he won with the biggest ever points.
Which he led and crashed out of,
And which he won by the biggest ever winning points margin at the end of the season. And I asked, you know, is 2019 Mark coming back? And he very quickly said, well, there's two components now. There's the rider and the bike. The 2019 rider, he believes, can come back, which is fantastic news for the championship. And for Mark personally, you know, one of the other questions I asked him over the weekend after the pole position lap was, does this mean that the fourth surgery is a success? And he says, well, we already knew the fourth surgery wasn't a success. I wake up in the morning and I'm not in constant pain. So just to see him going from that to being back at his, you know, believing he's at his best mentally is awesome. An absolute fair play to the guy, because no one wanted to see the nightmare that he had going on beforehand. But he, like I said, he split my question in two. And he said that the other part of it now was the bike. And where we kind of always assumed that, you know, it was 90% rider talent, 10% motorbike in the past, he says that with the arrival of aero, with the arrival of wings, with the latest generation of Michelin tires, with just how competitive the MotoGP grid is right now, where everyone's a champion, he says the bike plays a bigger role now. And he doesn't know if the Honda's good enough to let him do what he used to do. But, you know, from a sort of a non-partisan fan of the sport point of view, a Marc Marquez who's dialed back a couple of clicks is probably just about the best thing imaginable, because he's going to be wild and loose and fast and aggressive and fun, but the others are going to be able to tag on to the back of him, and he's not going to dominate the championship. That sounds like we're on the cards for an awesome 2023, to be honest.
Yeah.
No Friday morning running, the freight took a little bit of a while, and it was all in the plan to come from Aragon. There was just the Friday afternoon running, never mind the fact that it was wet. Do you think there's a future in that? Is that an option for all of the Grand Prix, less running? Do you think it ultimately made a difference come Sunday afternoon, Simon?
It would only have made a difference come Sunday afternoon had Saturday not been wet. It might have made a difference in the end, but it's only because we lost a day to wet weather in the end. In the end, the logistics plan worked really well, despite dodging a super typhoon to get the freight here. And I think we probably could have run on Friday morning if need be, but I get why they worked in that contingency. But this is something that we've questioned in the past, and we've been given a categoric no. It's never going to change, because Dorna are, at the end of the day, a company who make their money by selling TV rights, and they don't want to sell one session, one morning of action less a weekend. So no, we're stuck with what we've got, unless there are, you know, some weird exceptional circumstances.
I'd love to know how much revenue is generated by FP1, the worst, least watchable session in human history, every weekend.
Can you imagine how many people in the UK, for example, would have watched a Moto3 FP1 at 3 a.m. on a Friday morning? I have actually heard rumors in the past of like 3-digit viewing figures, like that low.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense to me.
I can beat all of that. When we were doing Eurosport, Ron Ringuth was the main commentator in German. And he was even more of a TV guy than a motorsports guy, if you follow. He had a great voice, had a great enthusiasm, but he was TV first and foremost rather than MotoGP like the rest of us. And he was always across the figures. Now, the penetration of Eurosport into Germany was something like 85%. This is kind of 20 years ago, which then was an enormous percentage. And Germany, you know, big population. Anyway, he got the numbers once of 125 Friday afternoon. Friday afternoon, this is, because we only did Friday afternoons, not Friday morning. And there was, I think he said there was something like less than 3,000 people watching, when normally they'd have, you know, on race day, 400,000, 500,000 people watching. And he said, and he came up with a line, he just said, it would be cheaper to put everybody on 747, standing room only, so they could come to Motegi, because it would be cheaper to take them to Motegi than do all the broadcast on the Friday. He was joking.
But he wasn't.
But you kind of know where he was coming from.
Yeah. Yeah. Look, I love MotoGP and you know, Moto2 and Moto3 too, but I really hope all of you have better things to do on Friday afternoon.
Honestly. Morning. Morning if
morning
you're in Europe.
And afternoon, yeah. Both of those.
I mean,
honestly,
I'm on site, and I have to admit, I use Moto2 FP1 to go and find people in the paddock.
It is another discussion for another day. But are they just going round in circles burning hydrocarbons, which in itself is a discussion that is being had, and we will need to have maybe over the winter.
We'll get back to the pod in a moment, but first a word about our partner Grammarly. No matter what kind of work you do, how you communicate is key. All those emails, reports, and presentations are equally important to the collaboration needed to get things done. And Grammarly can help. Grammarly is your AI writing partner to help you communicate more effectively and efficiently so you can make a bigger impact at work. I know from experience that Grammarly can help you save time on any writing task and ensure you feel confident about what you've produced. In fact, 96% of Grammarly's users report that Grammarly helps them craft more impactful writing, and their tone suggestions can help you navigate even the most difficult work conversations. Make a bigger impact at work with Grammarly. Sign up and download for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.
Taka Nakagami had a terrifying crash at Aragon just 7 days before his home Grand Prix at Motegi. Quite how he was able to get on his LCR Honda MotoGP bike, 300 horsepower, 158 kilos. It's trying to pull your arms out, let alone your hand that doesn't function properly. How in heaven's name did he even think about it, let alone get to the end of the Grand Prix?
All right, well, Simon and I are both making faces, and well, how did he think about it? It's the first Japanese GP since 2019, so he felt like he had to be there, and nobody told him no. Somebody should have told him no, because I've not seen his hand. I'm not his doctor. I don't know, maybe it's actually fine. Maybe it's a paper cut. But from Taka's words, here's what he said over the weekend. On Friday, I think after the running, he said that his glove was full of blood after the session. So there's just an open wound seeping blood while he's riding a bike. So that's great. And then over the rest of the weekend, it got worse to the point where he said that a doctor who's been looking at his hand over the course of the weekend said after Sunday's race that the situation with his fifth finger, one of the two injured fingers that were, I think, operated on already, was, in Taka's words, serious. So I don't know how to interpret that other than he may have done extra damage to his hand by riding this weekend in order to finish 29th or whatever. And again, this is not being disrespectful. He's hurt. Of course he's going to finish 29th. He's really hurt. He was really suffering. Even if you were to finish 10th, don't do that. And it's not up to him, because you can't expect him to stop himself. But somebody has to. Again, glove full of blood. What are we doing here? Come on.
I agree. Yeah, Val is right. It. Somebody didn't stop Marc Marquez riding at Jerez 4 days after his operation back in July 2020. It's the same thing over again.
The same people. The same people didn't stop Marc Marquez from riding 4 days after his operation at Jerez. And you would think that Honda management would have learned something, especially considering they've just signed Taka Nakagami to ride for them again next season. And yet, here we are. To answer the how of your question, Toby, how he managed to ride is that he was pumped full of drugs that probably required a therapeutic use exemption to mean that he passed doping control afterwards to be able to use them, and couldn't feel the damage being done to his hand in the process. He told us on Friday that the surgeon had said that 60% of the tendon in his hand, in his right finger, little finger, was gone.
Was gone.
And then he went and did more damage and it became gone, cut. And then he went and did more damage. So we're essentially in a situation where we have seen a rider so desperate to race in his home race that it may well cost him at best the use of his finger and maybe the finger as a whole. And no one in the championship has thought to step in and stop that, but instead has told him that he's a superhero for doing it. The damage to his hand is so bad that he was pleased that they didn't have to skin graft the wound closed. That's how bad it is. That's what we're talking about here. And that's beyond the fact that the tendon is you know, hanging on by a literal thread. So none of this is anything against Taka. I need to say that. This is about the system, not the rider, because the job of the rider is to go and race. But there has to be some sort of an emergency break in the system where it doesn't devolve all safety decisions to the rider. Taka's reputation is not the cleanest in MotoGP for someone who can be a bit loose and a bit aggressive and a bit, you know, he takes risks. We all saw the first corner at Barcelona earlier this year. And then they sent him out on track admitting that he couldn't feel his hand whenever he was doing frame braking control. Like, who heard those comments and didn't think they should take him off track instantly?
You get the feeling that, you know, you're past fit if you can. I know that's not the system. The system is different. But it seems to often equate to me, like, if you can do a lap time, then you're fit. Taka could do a lap time this weekend. On Friday, on Saturday and Sunday, he was gone. But on Friday, he could do a lap time. But and it, look, I'm just going to read off the quote from the transcript. After the race, the doctor checked again, said that it's pretty bad. It's quite serious. So we need to think about to see whether we need a surgery. So that's another surgery or not. Or it's okay like this. We can live like this or not. It's quite bad. I hate this. I hate all of this. All of it. I hate it a lot. I hated listening to it. I hate thinking about it now. Please keep the man out of Buriram and let him heal his hand and never do this again. No home race is worth this. If this was his final home race, it would not be worth it. And it's not even his final home race.
No, it's not.
This is the same story that's been going on in motorcycle racing for 20, 30, 40, 50 years. I'm just rather surprised that it's going on in 2022. We all did silly things when we were young, and we just needed a mature person to say, and they did at times, go, don't do that because you'll burn yourself. Don't do that because the tree will fall on your head. When I was a tree surgeon, all those kind of things, you know? And if he was battling for the championship and all those other separate discussions, maybe. I just always think Kevin Schwantz, you know, he regrets now riding when his wrists were so badly damaged, and he now regrets that. But of course, you can't see it at the time because you're just dazzled with, at least for Kevin, being at the sharp end. But for Tacker, love him as we do, he's not at the sharp end.
And here's the thing that, trying to word very carefully what I'm about to say here, the people who passed him fit are the people who performed the surgery on him. Because the MotoGP medical team come from the Drexus Hospital in Barcelona, and his surgery was performed by Dr. Xavier Mir at that clinic. And I know that obviously the local circuit doctor has a say in that fit unfit process, but I think more times than not we've seen that they defer to the resident experts in motorcycle medicine, which are those doctors who perform the surgery. And I don't know if that's a system that I want to continue.
Surgery was clearly good because he was fast on Friday, but I mean,
yeah, but 24 laps, lap on lap, yeah, are another animal, yeah, in the dry, yeah, in the dry, yeah.
And a crash on the same hand again.
Oh, don't.
No. He did.
Okay.
Yeah. It's everything else aside, regardless of when he had the surgery, regardless of when the damage was, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, I don't think it would be an unfair punishment to anyone in motorcycle racing if we introduced a rule that says if you have an open bleeding wound,
yeah,
you cannot ride a motorbike.
Absolutely.
And it's not that long since we've seen Aaron Canet have to pull out of a race weekend because of the massive nosebleeds he was getting every time he got in the bike after smashing his head off the dash of a car in a car crash. If you're bleeding, you shouldn't be racing. Plain and simple. That shouldn't be a controversial opinion, should it?
I don't think so. No. But it's what they do in football, and motorcycle racing loves to think about how,
football
are pansies. But in this case,
yeah. Yeah, you've got a lot of controversial opinions, Simon, but that's not one of them. So,
someone also asked me over the weekend if what did I expect regarding concussions, that they get a concussion check every time they bang their head. What sport would ever do something that crazy? And I was like, well, every sport apart from MotoGP. But that's enough. That's off topic.
Yeah. Joan Mir, 2020 world champion, was unable to ride with Suzuki, so it was Takuya Tsuda who jumped in on then now the number 85 bike. It had a massive engine failure. Surely a rod went through the block with the amount of oil and flame that was pouring out of the back of it, with about half of the race still to go. Very unusual to see an engine let go like that in this day and age. It used to be things that we used to see in the embryonic days of MotoGP, but that was back 20 years ago. Unusual, but a sad end to Suzuki's current MotoGP era at home in Japan.
I feel like I'm sticking a little bit of a pin in your balloon, Toby, because contacts to Suzuki will not tell me what happened, but all they'll tell me is it wasn't the engine. So I don't know.
Oh,
what...
come on. No. I've built and blown up more engines maybe than you, Simon. And I'm telling you this, that when there's that much flame, there is oil where it shouldn't be. And oil should be on the inside, not the outside.
There was definitely oil where it shouldn't be.
Guys, it's clear. It was the 2023 prototype that they're really hard at work on.
So... Yeah, someone sent me a tweet, and I'm sorry, I can't remember who it was, but it's genuinely one of the funniest, if not saddest, things I've read all day, to say that watching Takuma Tsuda's bike on fire at the side of the track was the perfect metaphor for Suzuki's current MotoGP project, because they've taken the perfect MotoGP bike and burnt it to the ground.
Yeah, not funny, but yeah, there's an irony in that, isn't there? There is an irony in that. So then, Fabio Quartararo has a lead of 18 points ahead of Pecco Bagnaia. Aleix Espargaró is in third position in the championship. He is 25 points back of Fabio Quartararo. Bastianini, we've mentioned him already in this podcast that he's got a bit of a shout of this championship, but he is 49 points back. There are 100 points still in play at the remaining four Grand Prix. They are Thailand, Australia, Malaysia, and then Valencia back in Spain in Europe. 16 down, 4 still to go. Keep in touch with the-race.com for all of your MotoGP news. I won't be here next week. I'll be working in the Moroccan desert. So Matt Beer will be back and you will be in his safe hands. In the meantime, from Val, Simon and myself, Toby, arigato.
The Athletic.